charge is an article of faith on every person who participates in that democracy. If you don't believe that the outcomes of the democracy are legitimate, it results in catastrophe. We don't have to guess at this. We were all around for January 6th. We saw what happened when the legitimacy of institutions and processes are questioned. People die, systems get over, sort of overturned or unraveled. And so we have to believe the system is worth investing in if we're going to commit to the work of making it more inclusive and to the work of reforming it. If you don't believe that democracy is the answer, it's very hard to get people to invest in voting, to invest in the political system and its outcomes, to see those outcomes as legitimate. And that if we're committed to both the country and the process for improving the country, then outcomes can be better than if we don't believe in the country and believe that the system is no longer useful. Then we're at a different starting point, which could turn very ugly very quickly.
Well, I can make an argument that it's already turned very ugly very quickly if you consider that on January 6th, people died. You know, we're really lucky that more people didn't die, but a lot of people were hurt. A lot of people, particularly our first responders, lost their careers, if not their lives, because they were so badly injured they couldn't work again.
It's ugly. But in the 1960s, a president was assassinated. A attorney general and presidential candidate was assassinated. Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, assassinated. Medgar Evers, assassinated. Hundreds of protests in the summer of 68. The Vietnam War protests where students at Kent State were killed. So if we think January 6th was bad, our grandparents would say, children, you have seen nothing yet. And this book is both a meditation on democracy, but also a warning that if we don't heed history, if we don't heed the life experiences of those who came before us, we, as the old saying goes, we are doomed to repeat these things. And January 6th then, instead of becoming this this terrible day following a presidential election, mm-hmm. becomes the beginning of a terrible decade, like the 60s, like the 1860s. And we've got an opportunity to avoid that outcome, but only if we get ahead of the problem now.
I want to read something from the book. You say you're talking about your plea, your desire that people engage in this reimagination, as you put it. You said, reimagination, however, is tricky business. It arises from the premise that who we are is no longer sufficient or is deeply flawed in some way. Ego, whether personal or national, does not mm-hmm. like confronting the truth. It's uncomfortable and invites an identity crisis. When a nation as large and diverse as the United States is overdue for a reimagination, those at the center of the national narrative are likely to feel threatened. I mean, you can understand why people who have been historically left out of the national narrative want in. But why should the people you're talking about here, who see themselves as threatened or on the being displaced or not wanting to be dominated, why should they participate in this kind of reimagination that you talk about?
Well, if they truly believe in the founding ideals of the country, not lip service stuff, but if they truly believe in it, they don't have a choice. I think Jill Lepore, the historian, has said that in the first presidential election in 1790, 6% of the people in this country were eligible to vote, and only half of them did. The story of our democracy is the story of excluded people seeking participation. And when they are denied that participation, they are also Americans. And Americans don't take lightly to be told, you're less than, you don't get to have freedom, it's just for these other people. You don't get to have liberty and rights or access to democracies for other people. So if they do not make democracy a more inviting exercise, if they do not make the country more inclusive, they will have to contend with the people they've excluded outside of democracy. We've had a civil war to answer this question. We've had a civil rights movement to answer these questions. People were lynched trying to get a better answer out of this question. Suffragists, abused and beaten trying to get better answers out of this question. But what never stops is the sort of spirit of progress. The second part of this, which sort of follows from the first, because we're a nation of 330, 50, 40, 50 million people. And if you think that democracy is only for 70% of those 350 million people, you squander massive amounts of talent and capabilities of your populace. Countries do not thrive when they squander the thing that makes them special, unique, which is to say they're people. So not only will those people not stand idly by, but those at the top that want a prosperous America or want to sort of hog the benefits of this country for themselves will find that there's less benefits, less resources, less good feelings to go around when exclusion is your politics.
But what about people who just don't see it that way and seem to believe, whether through force, through violence, through the ballot box, through domination, some kind of way that their narrowing of the American story is going to continue to prevail? What do you say to that?
Yeah, so the first thing is on January 7th, January 8th, January 9th, a lot of the people saying that 2020 was an undecided election or a fraudulent election, on January 7th, 8th, and 9th, they were saying, how dare Donald Trump? You know, this is beyond the pale. This is too far. And then what they learned was you don't get reelected. You don't have a chance in the Republican Party.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh. Produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Hello, my name is Ashley. I am a first-year MFA student.
So for this audio piece, I would like to talk about something that is very real for all of us, something that we all deal with, I think, at least periodically, either throughout the week, months, or years. It's something that comes across one's life ever so often, and that is the topic of anxiety. Anxiety is something that I've dealt with, honestly, throughout my entire life. There have been situations, just life circumstances that have created moments of anxiety and anxiousness as I have navigated or had to have navigated through life, whether that's systematically, societally, economically, all the things that make life what it is. Anxiety has been there. It's almost like, I mean, it's not really a friend in the way that it makes you feel, but it's one of the earliest memories of a feeling that I've had. Since moving to Pittsburgh and by myself and having to confront anxiety, having to confront what it's like moving to a place by yourself and not really around anybody that you know, and what it's like to rebuild again. The topic of anxiety and that feeling has grown. It's been a mixture of both anxiousness, excitement, and wonder about the possibilities here, but anxiety has seemed to always creep its way in. Even more so, I think about anxiety in relation to my art practice realistically, and how my certain ideas of anxiousness have creeped into that part of my being as well, feeling displaced in a way visually, and how I respond to the world around me has slowly, you know, creeped into my art practice. It's something that I am currently fighting through, as all artists have to deal with. We all have to deal with moments of pause, moments of reflection, moments of, I don't know what I'm doing right now. So, you know, in full transparency, that's where I am right now as I am navigating my first year in a grad program. You know, some artists who I admire also, you know, we navigate all of these things differently because we're all different people. For me, how I've navigated this has been to pause, and really trying to search for what it is that I'm looking for in this experience. Because I, outside of grad school, outside of the people that you meet, the studio visits, the networks that are potentially there, the residencies, the grants, this really is our time. These are some of the most important years that we will have. And so what is it that we want out of this? So I'm taking moments of pause, not because I don't want to do anything or that I'm not doing anything, but I am valuing the time that I have. And sometimes that time is just silence and really like writing in my sketchbook or in my journal. I'm finding that anxiety doesn't have to be this self-bullying, I would say, attitude towards yourself. Sometimes anxiety is showing you that there's something for you to pay attention to within your intuition and in your body and in your mind and in your spirit. And so my relationship to anxiety specifically has, with coming to Pittsburgh, has changed a lot. And I'm learning to, when feelings, whether it's happiness, anxiousness, depression, love, scared, fear, all of these different feelings, you know, how does one respond to this? So one thing that I've been trying to do, and I know it sounds so cliche at this point, but is meditation. I've been trying to listen to my mind, my spirit, and my body's desire for pause and meditate. And so I ask you to join me on this 10-minute meditation that's focused on breathing and really asking ourselves to pause.
Just invite yourself to get into whatever position feels best to you. Lovingly closing your eyes whenever you're ready. And letting yourself begin to drop in. Tuning in to your breath, your body, and even your thoughts. As you let your awareness shift into becoming the observer. Watching with a gentle sense of kindness and compassion. As you observe how you breathe, how you feel, what you think. Letting all of it be fine as it is. Nothing to judge. Just something to accept wholeheartedly. Invite your breath to become even more natural and comfortable to you now. Exploring what muscles you need to engage in order to do this. Finding what flow really feels best. Letting each inhale and exhale be unique. Feeling how every inhale eventually falls back into an exhale. And how every exhale eventually rises up into an inhale. And you are the observer of this beautiful cycle. The cycle that is a beautiful symbolism of the infinite. For just as your breath will continue to cycle for as long as you have this physical life, so too will cycles continue to exist in the cosmos and the universe as long as they exist. It is so natural. Invite yourself to relax into a feeling of comfort with the concept of cycles. Considering perhaps now a memory of a time that one season changed into another and it just felt magical. Whatever that transition was from one season to the other, bring it to mind now vividly. Where were you? What were you doing? How did it smell and feel? What's something that really sticks out, perhaps visually or emotionally or some other way? Identify what stands out to you. And why did it feel so good to be in that transition? Trust what answer you receive now. Feel yourself relaxing into your own wisdom. Recognizing that your wisdom recognizes just how important, crucial, and powerful cycles are. How they are natural and magnificent. Feeling yourself letting go of a need to know what the cycles will look like in any specific kind of way, but instead being open in your heart, open in your mind, open to the possibilities that all of the cycles that you enter into in life are indeed natural. And for your highest, most loving growth and evolution in this process of life. It is safe to let go. It is safe to trust. Allow yourself to listen to the following messages. Letting yourself choose them as either suggestions, truths, or creative possibilities that you can explore or perhaps be open to the idea of, whatever level you're at, whether you're full on accepting it as truth or just opening to the idea, trust that what you experience is right and perfect for you. What if everything that's led you to this moment is because you were meant to recognize the importance and power of the cycles in your life? What if being in flow and rhythm with the cycles of your life can lead you to more increased happiness, freedom, and joy? What if you are a deeply wise, infinite being? Just experience.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Annie Chan.
A big silly mouse, a Chinese acrobat, a youthful trapezist who smiles at the abyss. The mouse is a micro cat with super cat speed. She doesn't run, she flies. This is love, nothing more deliciously suicidal than desire.
Okay, one time I was sick. Went to me and my friends, we went to our friend's house, and we were like hanging out, and she brought her pet rat out, and I had never seen a pet rat before, and I held it and I took pictures with it, and then next day, I showed my brother the pictures. I was like, look, isn't this so cool? My friend has a pet rat. And then my brother was like, that's some gross-ass white people sh-. And, I felt great shame. That's all. That's it, dude.
Annie, I'm really bad at voice notes, but this is my rat or mice story. So a couple of years ago when I lived in Squirrel Hill, I had really bad mice problems. And so my roommate and I, we set up a bunch of mouse traps, and then almost every day for like 2 weeks, we would have, yeah, mice, at least like one mouse caught in one of the mouse traps. And yeah, I had to throw them out. And one time we had this like sticky mouse trap, and so that just like makes them stick to this like paper trap, but they don't die. So I just like heard something move in my room, and I was like, what the hell? And then yeah, it was this like a live mouse caught in this paper sticky mouse trap. And so I unfortunately had to like unalive it. Yeah, I had to kill it. I think I like made the mouse like walk towards the mouse trap. Oh my god, mice. Oh yeah, I like made this mouse like walk to the mouse trap. So I like, yeah, I murdered a mouse. I feel bad. Honestly, they were all pretty cute, but apparently they carry a lot of germs. So bad for the house. Oh yeah, and they did like, they ate a lot of our food and ripped through the bags. And yeah, they were being annoying. So, yeah, but I mean, well, that was my mouse story. I hope this helps for whatever project you're doing.
Also, one time, Jess just reminded me, Jess is out of town, and Penelope killed a mouse in the house, and I was too scared to pick it up, so I had to call Tabitha to walk over, and she grabbed the rat for me. And threw it away. And that's another rat story. Okay.
One step ahead of you. The foreshadowings of rat death. So I remembered when I woke up this morning that I have two rat stories that when woven together sort of helped me understand my intuitiveness, compassionate tendencies, and empathetic nature as a kid. I think this happened when I was 3 or 4 years old, but I remember one day at my parents' house in Kaneohe, coming outside, and we always kept our shoes outside of the house. So on our porch, I had my shoes, and I wanted to really quickly put on shoes to go run around outside in the yard, and I chose my galoshes. Why all kids have galoshes and put them on even when it's not raining, I don't know, but maybe it has something to do with the ease. So I stuck my right foot into one of my galoshes, and I felt a squiggly furry thing underfoot. And it cheeped or peeped, and it freaked me out. And I screamed and ran back into the house and was worried that I had squashed a rat or a mouse. And I guess later I found out that it was like a baby rat or a small mouse that had gone into my galoshes. Later on, maybe that same year, I was at my grandparents' house and came outside on their back porch to go see what my grandpa was up to. My grandpa had like a mother-in-law's quarters downstairs where he would do his stuff. It also had a washing machine, but it like had hit the man toilet and a separate area for where he'd keep his things and store items. he liked to shower down there. It's kind of like the future of the man cave. And so he had come out of his man cave and was like shirtless and like had just showered and was coming up to dinner. And I was at the top of the steps of the back porch. And he said, "Baby, don't move." And he told me not to move because there was something dangerous down below. And it was like a rat from under the house had run out. And my grandpa and pests do not mix. My grandfather was like the most vicious when it came to like swatting flies, getting anything that would somehow ruin food, spoil things, make his family sick. He was like aggro about it. And this man, wearing his locals only slipper, picked up his foot and smashed that f***ing rat, Ozzy Osbourne style. And I heard it scream, and blood gushed out from underneath his foot. And I mean, I felt like the most protected, the most horrified. I'll never forget this, but it's like my baby mouse step sort of foreshadowed what I was about to witness from my grandfather. Two rats underfoot.
When I was a kid, my older sister rescued two rats from the school lab. I don't know if she stole them or... It seemed like she stole them from the lab. I really don't know exactly what happened. Or like that they were gonna be used in some sort of experiment. And I'm not really sure. I can't remember the details. But anyway, one day she just came home with two white rats. And she named them Ralph and Fred. And they were brothers. They were really close. At first I was really scared of them, because I never had a pet rat before. I think at that point I had only had pet goldfish, and maybe I had had a bunny by then, I don't remember, but I remember I was scared to pick them up, and I thought they would bite me, but they didn't. They were actually really sweet. And they like to play together. And I really don't know how long we had them, but one day we found one of them had broken, I think, from playing, from like rolling around and stuff. One of them broke their neck. And it was really sad. The one that was alive was crying. And he would sleep where the other one died. And he basically got super depressed that his brother died. And I guess I don't know if he felt like guilty because he died like while they were playing. I know I would. But he stopped taking care of himself. Like, his nails grew really long from not scratching. And he just kind of withered away because he just was so depressed. It was so sad. But anyway, that's my rat story. Both of the rats ended up dying early. One from rough housing, breaking his neck, and the other one from depression from his brother dying.
I have a mouse story. So in my studio at CMU, as we were packing up, like, because we were, I was a third year, so I was going to graduate, and so they gave us, like, a deadline to be kicked out, and I had my, like, all my installation deinstalled in my studio, and a mouse had made a cozy home in the rug that was in my install. I had it rolled up, and I started to unroll it so I could, like, take pictures of the rug and sell it, and then a little mouse scurried out, and I screamed, like, I really screamed and terrified everybody who was there. Then I was like, mouse! And that was the start of one of many mouse incidents. And yeah, there were just, it became evident that there are mice in the CMU studios. I don't know if it's still a problem now, but that was 2 years ago now.
Damn.
Anyway, that's my mouse story. Miss you, bye.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Morgan Thomas Schenkweiler. I'm ready.
Hi, everybody.
It only seems fair that after I interviewed Penn and Wyeth, that I be interviewed by them.
Hi, everybody. Hi, everybody. How are you doing today? My name is Silhouette. Let's go. Hi, everybody. How are you doing today? My name is Silhouette. I like scratching, watching.
Hi, Buttercup, a.k.a. Morgan. My name is Gertrude. And I like fried pickles with butter and sauerkraut with a little bit of lemon. And don't forget the cheese. So let us begin.
Hi, everybody! How are you doing today? My name is Silhouette, and I like scratching my chin.
Hi! Hi, everybody! Hi, Buttercup, a.k.a. Morgie Morgan. Hi, Buttercup, a.k.a. Morgie Morgan. My name is Gertrude, and I like fried pickles with butter on top and sauerkraut with a little bit of lemon, and don't forget the cheese, so let us begin. Hi, Buttercup!
I thought you was about to, like, go for there.
Hold on, and you raise
Like when you like you're laughing, but you can't actually like breathe. It's
ha ha ha. Will you keep my laugh in this?
Maybe.
I really want you to.
We might just all be laughing at this point. That's all we've recorded so far.
Hi, Buttercup, aka Morgan Morgan. My name is Gertrude, and I like fried pickles with the butter on top and sauerkraut with a little bit of
You're like
it's hard to say a little bit of lemon.
A little bit of lemon.
A little bit of lemon.
A little That's what I do. I'm sorry. Hi, Buttercup, a.k.a. Morgan Morgan. My name is Gertrude, and I like fried pickles with butter on top and sauerkraut with a little bit of lemon. And don't forget the cheese! So let's begin. Hi, may we introduce...
No, it's like anything. If you say a word too many times...
Introduce.
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 There it is.
Introduce. Introduce. May we introduce...
Sorry. Introduce.
Introduce. May we introduce Morgan Morgan. And Morgan Morgan, we have some questions for you today.
Yes, I would love to answer your questions.
Okay, Morgan Morgan. The first question will be asked by... my friend here, Silhouette.
That's not how you say my name. It's Silhouette.
Okay, Silhouette. Now, may you ask our first question?
Of course. What is your favorite podcast? What is your favorite pasta?
What is my favorite pasta?
Yes!
Oh, Silhouette, that's an excellent question.
That's not how you pronounce my name.
Silhouette! Excellent question. My favorite pasta, I think, I'm not actually a huge fan of pasta, but...
Then why don't you eat it every time we have pasta?
I don't really like pasta.
But you eat it!
Yeah, because I'm not... Because I'm polite.
Then you like pasta!
I'm not a huge fan, but my favorite pasta would probably be a really good ravioli.
What? What?
Okay, well, moving on from that...
What?
Okay, sounds good. Okay, moving on from that. What?
What?
What teams do you cheer for?
The Eagles, exclusively.
What else?
Oh, I have a Phillies hat on right now.
What else?
I cheer for any team that my children are participating on. Who else do I cheer for?
You cheer for...
The 76ers?
76ers.
Okay.
And your hockey team?
The Flyers.
Yes.
That's right.
Do you like the smell of eggs?
No, I do not like the smell of eggs.
I see why you don't. They're a little bit stinky. Next question. Do you like to chew on bones?
What? Do I like to chew on bones?
Yes.
No, I do not generally chew on bones.
How come? I mean, it's a very, very good thing to do.
You mean that... That thing inside?
The marrow.
Yes.
I do like bone marrow.
I mean, but you have to eat the bone with it. It's so good. I mean,
My teeth aren't made for that. Yeah.
My mom's a human. My dad's a dog. I like chewing on bones, but I don't really have good bone teeth. I just really like cut them.
Okay, moving on to the next question.
Do you like the texture of slimy frogs?
Do I like the texture of slimy frogs?
Yes, that's the question, my dear.
Yes, I kind of do like the texture.
Do you like the name we call you?
What name do you call me?
Morby Morgan.
Is that what you call me to my face or behind my back?
To your face and behind your back. Behind your back like, oh, Morgan. So annoying.
That's how I talk about you behind your back, too.
Really so sad. Annoying. So annoying.
Yeah, I love that name.
That's good, because we thought you would. Okay, moving on. This question is going to be asked by Simu.
That's enough. Do you like us?
Do I like you?
Yeah.
My children?
No one are your children. She's your granny.
Yeah.
I love you.
Well, you don't even know me.
We come to record weird people.
But you're her granny?
Yes. You know, we're best friends.
Best friend granny reporters?
Yes. I mean, we're pretty old for this job, but
I took it. Next question is going to be asked by Gertrude.
Hey, I see you like fizzy things. So do you want to get a fried pickle or do you want to keep recording?
I would much rather be eating fried pickles right now.
Okay, let's go!
Here's a fried pickle. Here's a fried pickle. These are fried shrimp. And then the dragon. Oh, yeah. I am interviewing you, not reading you a book. Well, that's all our questions.
There wasn't even a question in that question.
That was a question. Why do you question my question?
This was a bizarre interview.
Okay, well, that's it for today. Thank you, Morgan. I really like to have you here. We just would love to have you again. So let's say bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for having me and for interviewing me today. I feel heard. That was your best one yet.
Let's close our eyes.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
My name is Logan Larson.
we go.
Hit spring, shuffle, hop. Hit spring, hit spring, hit spring. Brush step and back, brush step and back, brush step and back, brush step, ball change, brush step, ball change, step, ball change, brush step and step together.
So fast, that looks like.
Thank you.
You are listening to Is Sound a Language?
Alina Akbar Khan.
Hello, this is Alina Akbar Khan in conversation with Bulam Kumavid, who is a second year MFA student. I'm going to be interviewing Bulamko. Hi, Bulamko.
Hi, Alina.
Bulamko, I hope that I said your last name correctly. Is it Mubid?
No, it's actually Mbete.
I'm so sorry that I got your last name wrong.
That's fine. It's actually funny because I had a long layover in Cairo, and so I took a tour of the city, and the tour guide actually pronounced it in the same way. So it's refreshing to hear it pronounced in a different way.
Okay, tell me about this trip to Cairo. That sounds exciting.
It was. So it was a stopover on a trip back to South Africa for my brother's wedding.
Oh.
So basically, I spent about 8 hours touring the city.
Oh, that's exciting.
So we went to... Where did we start? We went to the pyramids. So the pyramids of Giza. And they're actually quite... The different pyramids and like the Sphinx are quite far apart, so you actually have to like travel by walking or by car, or you can get a camel ride.
Oh, right.
So we walked quite a bit, drove part of the way, and then there was a camel ride that was part of the tour.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah, it was great. It's incredible to see. It's really like a marvel.
And this was quite recent, right?
Yes, this was in November of 2024. Yeah.
And then you came back to Pittsburgh.
Well, after the wedding.
After the wedding.
Yeah. But let me tell you more about the tour.
Yeah.
And the day of the tour. So, went to the pyramids. We saw that. I documented that. And then after that, I think we... Oh, then after that, we went to a place that makes papyrus. So they make papyrus in the like traditional indigenous way.
But what is papyrus?
Paper.
Oh, that is so interesting.
Yeah, I think it's the first form of paper known to man. So it's made from like a lotus plant.
Oh, right.
And it's processed by hand. So we went to like a Egyptian government facility that produces that, and they show you the process of how they produce it, and then they also sell artworks made out of papyrus.
I love that.
Yeah, it was good to see, but it's very touristy because all the tourists are going there, and tour groups work specifically with these facilities because it's also authentic. And then after that, we went to a place that makes perfumes in the indigenous traditional way. And they explain what each perfume does. Because each perfume also has a health benefit.
Oh.
So, like, whether it's something that, like, will relieve headaches or aches and pains, that kind of thing. Or things for your endocrine system. So that was also really beautiful. And at the place that makes perfumes, they also make glass that contains the perfume. So you're able to see... The artisan make the glass for the perfumes.
Oh, wow. Like a life performative act.
Yeah. That also very so touristy.
Right.
Yeah.
Like it's like part of the spectacle.
Yes. Exactly.
The bazaar and like the perfume.
Yeah. The
paper. Right.
Yeah. And they've built like a really nice atmosphere around it. Because you sit there, you have tea, they bring you the perfumes. To smell them, they explain what it does for you, so it's interesting. And then after that, went to the Egyptian National Museum, which is interesting when you've seen Egyptian artifacts in other museums, because the grandeur of that versus seeing it in Egypt just like kind of like in a glass case or in a corner that's dusty, that's not like super well lit. It's like they are very different ways of display. And I guess it also has to do with like how the value gets attributed in like the different spaces, right? So it's like living amongst the ruins as opposed to like glorifying the ruins.
Like the Yeah, the latter, sorry. I'm forgetting what it means in English, the former and the latter. Like, I always forget it. But what you said, the last bit, I suppose, reminded me, like, it's all extraction, right? Like, and when you're in the site itself, it's a little underwhelming because you have seen the extracted versions out in the world.
You mean at, like, international museums?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I also wanted to ask, were there any permanent installations in front of the Pyramid of Giza? Because they made, like, a huge art and culture authority across the Middle East. They worked with the site of where the Pyramids of Giza are erected. And they made, like, art around that, which is so funny. The pictures of it were so funny, like, but I wonder if those were permanent installations and you were able to see some of them.
Oh my gosh. So I didn't notice them just because of how much busyness there was around the space.
Right.
And when I arrived, we kind of stopped in the parking lot, went through the ticketing office and then to the site.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't notice any permanent installations of artworks. What I did notice is that there were, like, further excavations happening in the area.
Oh.
And then my tour guide explained that basically there were more ruins that they had found that they're in process of excavating, and then they're also in the process of building a updated museum, so that was also visible in the landscape, but I didn't see these artworks.
I'm glad that you didn't, because the pictures were so funny. I swear to God.
But I mean, also in comparison, I think the pyramids will always dwarf anything else. So it's kind of hard to imagine there being an art installation that could actually be noticeably speaking to the pyramids.
Yeah, and that art was trying very hard to speak to the pyramids, which is why it just failed ridiculously. And the critiques of those works, it was just so funny.
I know there are a whole lot of concerts that happen. I think it's in front of the Sphinx, and then they, like, do a light show and they project stuff onto the pyramids.
Oh, God.
But that's, like, very explicit. Those are part of, like, artist performances, like music performances and concerts.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the only way you could do something that actually, like, really interfaces with it. Mm. But it's still super contrived, I think.
Yeah. But, I mean, for me, that works. Like, I've seen a lot of that in Saudi Arabia, where there's, like, excavations happening and then they will have light shows, but then that's work for the public. But the public art installations that I'm talking about, they are conceptual in the middle of a desert, in the middle of, like, a very popular touristy and they're trying very hard to conceptually relate to the Sphinx. And I mean, this one work that I'm reminded of, it was like it came out of a digital world, quote unquote, like, as the artist said that it was. So, like, I don't know where I'm going with this, but, like, it felt like it was trying to build up, it was trying to be a game sphere in front of the Sphinx. So, like, and it wasn't an actual game, it was just visually trying to be a game in front of the Sphinx. So, and it was very ugly too, like, it was just black and white and purple and blue, and colors were just, like, so, and the whole attempt was to not do anything that the desert would allow, like, not to integrate with the desert, to stand out as much as possible.
So that's funny that you say that, because the only space that is, like, really vast and deserty is where the pyramids actually are. Like, outside of that, there's so much visual clutter. There's so much, like, there's so many apartment buildings, there's so many people, there's so many cars, there's, like, so much noise and chaos. So I can't imagine that would actually stand out from the chaos of, like, the daily living.
Right.
Because there's so much happening just outside of the site.
I think that is interesting because, like, after that show was up, like, there were a lot of critical, like, pieces of critical writing about how wrong the whole thing was. Not wrong ethically, but just wrong, I mean, visually. And I said, so every curator or people who went there to write about it didn't have good things to say about it, which is, I think, because the pieces were trying very hard to be Instagrammable. So as long as you were just looking at the pictures, the pictures showed you something else, but when you went there and tried to write about it, you would see something different.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Because it puts it into context.
Right.
When you're there and there's like chaos happening around you.
Right.
Like that colorful piece of thing doesn't mean as much.
Right.
When everything else around it is super colorful.
Exactly.
Or dusty.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Okay, Balamko, we're almost there. We just have 2 more minutes to go through, 2 more minutes of this. What else? So, any other piece of, like, landscape art that you want to share with me in the next 2 minutes?
Oh, that's a big question. So, there's actually a program in South Africa called, I think it's Tankwa Karoo Arts or Tankwa Arts,
mm-hmm.
but it's basically also an attempt to kind of introduce contemporary art into like the desert scape or environment.
Right.
So a few artists that I've been at university with or artists that like I know of in the industry that are like contemporaries have actually done this residency. So they've like created large scale installations which have been installed in the desert, which is called the Karoo in South Africa. So I think that's an interesting thing to think about because that part of the desert is not as grand as the desert by the pyramids of Giza.
Right.
So the landscape is like, doesn't have like these dunes.
Okay.
It's pretty flat. Has very like short shrubs,
right?
And so I think like the opportunity to create like an installation or an artwork that is more visually striking is more possible there, but in the same breath it takes people so long to get to the site.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like different things like having a site like that in the city in Giza with Cairo,
right,
versus having something that's out of the city.
Thank you so much, Balamko. That was such a perfect answer.
You are listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Hi, I'm Melinda Crawford, a Scottish fiddler, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Ever lose your keys? Is that normal aging, dementia, or something else? Fear often stops us from asking for a simple checkup from the neck up. Knowing your numbers, blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol are common, but your cognitive numbers are also important. Request our free guide. It's filled with tips for better brain health, facts about dementia, and much more. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Your brain will thank you.
Hey, look, everyone, it's Mando!
Everybody ready?
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to another episode of Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio or the Rich Program, depending on where you are located. I am Mando Richard, and I'm going to try real hard to have a mistake-free show today. The last 2 weeks have been a little crazy, haven't they? All right, anyway, we have a liquored up set, we'll have a folk rock set about the middle of the show, and a gospel set at the end, so we got everything covered here. Here comes a song from the wilds of Long Island and the Feinberg Brothers.
Bar pretzels, barmaids, they work up your thirst. A hard day at work and you'll think of your first. Your troubles, they leave you once you walk through that door. Hey, your pain melts away with a couple beers more. At the table in the corner,
a man in a suit. His clothes have been stained from the tears and the booze. His shoes have been shined, no, he doesn't look poor. But his mind is still aching for a couple beers more. Bar pretzels, bar mates, they work up your thirst. A hard day at work and you think of your first. Your troubles, they leave you once you walk through that door. Hey, your pain melts away with a couple beers more. Fluorescent lights, they all work together, but come here at night to escape your wife's nagging and to put off their chores. But they'll stay here together for a couple beers more. Bar pretzels, barmaids, hey, work up your thirst. A hard day at work and you think of you first. Your troubles, they leave you once you walk through that door. Your pain melts away with a couple beers more. By the jukebox there's a boy who don't look too old. He's holding a girl who's been down a rough road. But the boy doesn't know what the girl has in store. So he'll be back here later for a couple beers more. Bar pretzels, barmaids, they work up your thirst. A hard day at work and you'll think of you first. Your troubles, they leave you once you walk through that door. Hey, your pain melts away with a couple beers more.